Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast we do here at risky.biz that is mostly for people who work in policy and government. My name is Patrick Gray, and I'm joined, of course, by Tom Uren, who writes our Seriously Risky Business newsletter, and we're going to get into it in just a moment. Big thanks to the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative for supporting this work, and also to our founding corporate sponsor, Proofpoint. Now, Tom, you've covered two things in this week's newsletter that are, I guess, you know, they're items that have been kind of covered to death elsewhere, but you've actually managed to find some fresh angles on them. A lot of people are zeroing in. So the two topics are the Iranian cyber attacks against Albania that have led to quite substantial diplomatic fallout. So we'll get to that one in a little while. But first up, we're going to talk about the Twitter Mudge whistleblowing hoo-ha. You know, a lot of the coverage is really zeroing in on what these, what Mudge's disclosures mean for Twitter's sale to Elon Musk, and other people have written stories sort of questioning Mudge's credibility. And, you know, here you are actually looking at the parts of it that really matter from a policy and national security perspective. You argue in this week's newsletter that over-provisioning of access to Twitter staff, because I think the allegation is something like 50% of Twitter's staff have access to all user data, whether or not it's quite that bad, we don't know. But you argue in this week's newsletter that that is both a national security threat and also an indication that the United States needs better data governance regulation.
Yeah, so I think the way Mudge describes it is that Twitter is in a place where there's just it's got no idea where data goes, what it's used for, or how they collected it. And so therefore, when they've got engineers that are trying to keep the enterprise running, they have to have very broad access in order to wrangle all these different data flows that they really don't have any governance around. And so if you get someone who turns up as an agent of a foreign power, they inevitably, if they're an engineer, get a whole lot of access that they don't need.
He's argued that the logging is quite terrible. So if someone is doing some gnarly stuff, you're not necessarily going to detect it.
Yeah. So what another part of his testimony talks about how Twitter just doesn't have any incentive to try and deal with that kind of insider threat as a problem. And I suppose from the point of view of a government, if you'd said 15 years ago, Twitter is going to become so important that it'll be that the safety and security of user data will be a national security problem, everyone would probably have laughed at you. It's not something that's even on the radar. But as Twitter and other big tech companies have become more and more important, the security of that kind of data actually becomes a national security problem, especially when you combine it with other stuff that you can already get. So the example we already know about is that the Saudis bribed a Twitter employee and they got that person to give up the personal information of dissidents in Saudi Arabia. And it's not clear exactly what happened to those dissidents, but Saudi Arabia does have a track record of pretty harsh persecution of activists.
Well, and journalists as well, right, in the case of Jamal Khashoggi. So, you know, and not only can, you know, insiders at Twitter with the right access, not only can they de-anonymize pseudonymous or anonymous accounts that might be influential within a particular political sphere, but they can also do things like locate, you know, check the IP address that a user is logging in from in the case of, you know, someone who's deemed to be an enemy of the state by whatever regime. If they've got someone inside Twitter, they can say, yeah, they logged in from this IP address, which gives them, you know, a pretty solid idea of where that person is.
Yeah,
so we are talking about legitimate life and death safety issues.
Yeah. In Mudge's testimony to the Senate, he talked about not just IP address, but what other social media accounts they were attached to, things like location, which I presume actually comes from the IP address. I'd call it a pattern of life when they logged in, what they did. So, you know, it's not a surprise for heavy Twitter users. There's a lot of information there. And there's just no incentive for Twitter to deal with it as a national security problem. And I think there's a problem with what the government and society as a whole would like Twitter how seriously the government and society as a whole would like Twitter to approach this as a problem, and how seriously Twitter actually does. So there's a story that Mudge relays where he tells an executive, look, I'm pretty confident we've got a foreign agent in Twitter. And their reply was, well, why do we care? We've already got one. What more does one hurt? Now, I'm not sure, and we've talked about this, whether this was said in jest or not, but I think there is a real element there that having a foreign agent on your payroll doesn't affect the share price. Searching them out and making sure that you don't have them is expensive and hard. And so there's a real reason, I think, that governments need some sort of regulation or oversight to encourage tech companies to do more for that kind of insider threat.
Yeah. I mean, we should talk about why this is a security risk to, you know, Twitter's home country, the United States. Like in the case of, you know, and it did come up in Mudge's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee, that one of the insiders that's alleged to work for a foreign power, that's, you know, they're the FBI apparently told Twitter that they had a Chinese MSS agent on their payroll, right? And that's really not what you want. And of course, we've spoken about it in terms of journalists, dissidents. Some of them might be refugees in the United States. So it is directly relevant to US national security. Don't forget, too, that insiders might be able to read the direct messages of various prominent figures in the United States. So it is actually a legitimate issue. And that anecdote about the Twitter executive, whether you believe it or not, it can't be denied that, you know, an almost rational reaction of an executive in that situation is to say, well, what do you want me to do about it? You know, because it's not really their job.
Yeah, that's right. I think there is a
but
real
maybe
question.
Maybe it should be, I guess, is what you argued in the newsletter.
Yeah. I think I don't expect Twitter or Facebook or Google to become counter-espionage agencies, right? I think that's unreasonable. That's not their job. But I think that they should take these risks seriously and have at least some effort to try and figure out how they cooperate with the government and counterintelligence agencies to detect and get rid of, you know, people you don't want in your organization. I think
I think you become less of a honeypot, you know, that's the wrong term actually, because that's, you know, used differently in espionage, isn't it? But you want to become less of a magnet too for foreign agents, right? Like if you do have a large site like Twitter where the allegation is every engineer is over provisioned access, then of course, you know, that's a giant magnet to pull in foreign agents, because the chances that they're going to wind up in a juicy, privileged position if they get a job there are extremely high.
Yeah. And going back to the national security risk, there's a case earlier this year where MSS agents in the States were harassing US citizens, former Chinese who'd moved to the States and were running for political office. And so there are examples where the MSS has been quite audacious, aggressive in intelligence gathering on US soil about US citizens.
Yeah, they got thugs everywhere, like no doubt, right? And I guess the question becomes, right, so what's the mechanism through which you fix this? And interestingly enough, Bloomberg has reported that Lindsey Graham, the Republican, and progressive Democrat Elizabeth Warren are working together on this issue. So there's a bit of bipartisan cooperation here. And interestingly enough, Lindsey Graham is like floating the idea of, hey, maybe there should be a licensing scheme for these companies to operate. So, you know, you can threaten to revoke their license if they're not acting responsibly and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that seems like an extremely dangerous idea, because the next Donald Trump, as he wrote in the newsletter, the next Donald Trump would threaten to pull their license, you know, faster than you can say kefefi, right? To sort of try to get them to be friendlier to their interests. So I think a licensing scheme, probably not a great idea, but certainly proper big stick regulation seems to be a thought here.
Yeah, so what occurs to me is something like you must at least have procedures in place to try and figure out if these people are in your company, and, you know, report on them. And
Well, I mean, how would you do that, right? Like, because you just said that they shouldn't be a counter-espionage, you know, shouldn't have a counter-espionage
I think every company has insider threat risk, right?
Yeah, so you're just talking about generally, like, actually having decent logging and provisioning.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's just an extension of what a company should be doing anyway, but just making sure that they actually are doing it. And that there's some, that you're giving them a good reason to do what they should be doing anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's quite rational too that the board isn't going to want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to fix Twitter's security problems because Twitter loses money, right? And it's going to be a very tough sell to go to the board and say, you know, we should really be doing this because national security, right? It's going to extend our losses and drop our share price, but that's what we should be doing. Whereas if you have a regulation in place that says, well, you have to do this or we're going to fine you a gajillion dollars, that tends to be something the board will pay attention to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there would be a few extra things like, you know, having a liaison person nominated for, I guess, the FBI or something like that maybe would make sense.
Well, I'd be surprised if they don't have that already. I mean, you know, the allegation is that the FBI did tell them that they had a Chinese MSS agent, you know, in the company, which would be difficult to do if they didn't have some sort of liaison.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking about is you'd have a person who's a liaison with the responsibility for that particular, you know, dealing with insider threat and counter-espionage topics. So instead of
I think
just
you're too much of a former intelligence guy when it comes to this part of the conversation, to be honest,
maybe,
Tom.
Maybe.
You know, like they need to hire a spy hunter, you know? Like I reckon maybe we just start off by not giving everyone access to everything and maybe logging stuff so that when the FBI comes along and says this guy, you know, works for the intelligence service of Liechtenstein, you can actually go back and look at what they've touched. You know, that might be a good first step and a decent compromise rather than hiring, you know, teams of spy hunters.
I didn't think I was suggesting that, but yes, I agree.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Now, look, another tired topic, right, as done elsewhere, that you've actually managed to bring life to is you've written a lot about what's going on between Albania and Iran. Now, unless you've been hiding under a rock, you would know that in response to some cyber attacks earlier in the year, Albania has severed diplomatic ties with Iran because Iran was apparently behind this attack because there are thousands of people from an Iranian opposition party who live in Albania under asylum, and they were organizing a party conference and Iran didn't like it. And, you know, there were attacks. So in response, Albania has, you know, thrown the Iranian embassy out of its country, severed diplomatic ties. And there's a second part to this story, which is there have been US sanctions also against Iran, and there are more attacks ongoing at the moment, right? So that Albania has attributed to Iran. So this whole thing is kind of escalating into, if not cyber war, then cyber conflict, or as you have previously referred to it as cyber embuggerance. But I guess what you've written about is like, there's a wrinkle here, which is the West is trying to renegotiate a nuclear treaty with Iran. So how hard do you want to penalize them for doing some stuff on the internet?
Yeah, exactly. It occurs to me that the states you really worry about going rogue, Iran, North Korea, are both states that you worry about going rogue from a nuclear perspective as well. So what are the options that you have to try and discourage them on both fronts? And you really want,
you know,
when they're
already sanctioned up the wazoo, there's only so many levers you got left to pull, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you've got any levers left, you want to say, let's reserve them for the nuclear problem. That's the big pressing issue. None of us want to die in a ball of nuclear fire. And so how do we stop or draw a line and say that this kind of behavior is unacceptable? I guess the real problem is that if you don't do anything about Iran conducting these kinds of attacks willy-nilly, what's to stop other states doing it and it becoming the de facto acceptable behavior when you get, you know, just the next step beyond a diplomatic demarche letter is cyber attack on government infrastructure. That's not a world we want to live in.
No, and we're talking about very destructive and disruptive wiper attacks. You know, so I believe this latest round has stopped Albanian border crossings from being able to let people through. Like, it's disruptive. But to call it war, you know, like, let's not go there, but, you know, conflict, cyber conflict.
Yeah, it's definitely disruptive. And I suppose the real problem is that the victims are essentially innocent parties. They're just citizens, and not even necessarily Albanian citizens, going about their lives. So I have some sympathy for cyber operations that are targeted and achieve some purpose when they're focused on people who are relevant. So I think these kinds of disproportionate and untargeted attacks, not the thing you want.
But I mean, there is a bit of a complication there, right? So in the case of Stuxnet, Iran sticking, you know, waving its hands about and saying, well, you Stuxnetted us, that's different, okay? Like, that's not even worth responding to. Everybody knows that that's different. That was a military campaign with a military objective, which is to disrupt Iran's plans to develop nuclear weapons, right? So seems fair enough. Where it does get a bit more complicated, though, is the predatory sparrow attacks. So we have seen attackers, which are presumably Israeli government, targeting Iranian civilian infrastructure. Now, they've done some pretty sensible scoping there, like they've disrupted petrol stations and whatnot, but have rung ahead and warned emergency services to make sure they have full tanks and things. So they're trying to disrupt loss of life, okay? But ultimately, they still are inconveniencing normal Iranians, the same way that everyday Albanians are being inconvenienced here. Now, I think what you can say in Israel's defense here is that Israel likely kicked off that campaign in response to Iran's attacks against its critical infrastructure. So that really is a tit-for-tat relation. But it certainly seems that you can understand why the Iranians can just say, well, okay, this is clearly just how things are done these days, and now they're doing something similar to Albania. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought about for quite a bit. And, you know, what is the real difference? So I think, ironically, I think Stuxnet, although you can understand it from a Western perspective, from an Iranian perspective, we just got attacked out of nowhere. And we're looking after our vital interests by developing a nuclear program. Clearly,
but it didn't inconvenience normal people, right? So
no, that's right.
It is in a different category.
Once upon a time in my previous job, I was asked to go on a podcast with the International Red Cross. And we had a Chinese professor, an Iranian diplomat, and myself, and an Indonesian academic as well. And we went through the process of recording a podcast. Fine, because everyone wanted to get their lines straight. And when it came to actually record it, the Iranian diplomat just went off his rocker about Stuxnet. So off the script. And I don't think
so you did a preparation call and then,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
It was all normal and then he's like, death to America, so your horrible bits and bytes.
Yeah, I guess the point is that, I think they may feel like they have a case there. So I actually think the predatory sparrow example conflict is a much stronger example where Iran has behaved irresponsibly and the presumed Israeli response has been quite restrained. So Iran kicked that off by trying to poison water supply, and it's done a number of things that are quite destructive in a way that could likely kill people. And also, this is like a tradition going back to the, I think it was 2008, maybe, Iran launched DDoS attacks against American banks. So they're quite happy to have attacks that are not targeted against people, or I guess I would call them stakeholders. And so there's a long history of disproportionate, loosely targeted responses by Iran.
Yeah, I guess all I'm getting at is it makes me look at the predatory sparrow stuff in a slightly different light, right? Because, okay, you do want to respond to Iranian actors hitting your water infrastructure, right? But I guess now that we're seeing Iran do this to Albania, I'm wondering if the predatory sparrow stuff is the right way to go. I mean, I get that, you know, this is Iran reaping what it sows, but you also kind of think, well, is Israel, by doing this, presumably Israel, as we always say, you know, is it actually helping us establish norms that we're happy with? And I'm just, it's starting to feel a bit uneasy about that one, to be honest.
Yeah, and I guess the question is there a better option that's not a cyber operation?
Well, and that's what your piece talks about, right? And then it's like, well, targeted sanctions, whatever, but they tend to be ignored by regimes that are already under heavy sanction and who have these nuclear negotiations going on, which actually give them a bit of leverage.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's an interesting dilemma. I really do think this is a significant moment in the way that cyber operations are conducted in terms of keeping a lid on what's acceptable. And yeah, I think there's a real dilemma here, though.
Well, it is an international relations cyber pickle. let's just coin that term right here. But look, it's a very, very thoughtfully written piece. Tom, so well done on that. And as I say, that one should be out by the time this podcast hits the feed. But that's all we're going to talk about this week. There's, of course, you know, a bunch more stuff in the newsletter. People can go to risky.biz/subscribe and subscribe to that. But Tom Uren, a pleasure as always, my friend. Great to chat to you, and we'll do it again next week.
Thanks, Pat.